Welcome to Soundbites, a series about the food we eat. We're going to spend the next year examining the entire system of how food gets to the farm to your table, including the history, politics, health, and environmental concerns, and the economics of wholesome food. You're already familiar with some of the issues. Our neighborhoods have become food deserts, with not a supermarket to be seen around us for miles. Our children are unhealthy with type 2 diabetes and high blood pressure showing up at younger and younger ages. Many of us die too young from preventable diseases. We believe it doesn't have to be this way. Over the coming year, we're going to share stories about our food. We'll explore how farms, both urban and rural, can feed and employ our people, how we can get fresh produce to our citizens, how we can take care of the environment, and how we can create a 21st century food system that is more just and healthier for each of us and our world. We believe it can be done. Please join us as we explore how we get there together. This week on Soundbites, we check back on a case we've been covering since last fall, that of the Brickyard Educational Farm in Montgomery County, trying to survive after 30 years in the face of potential development of soccer fields. It's a huge issue for many people, and also has to do with saving rare seeds. We'll also hear about pesticides and our children's health when we talk with Dr. Lauren Gerritsen, Professor Emeritus of Pediatrics at Emory University, who co-authored an op-ed piece on that particular subject. As we continue our look at pesticides in our environment, which is one of the major issues being battled and discussed and fought inside the Maryland State Legislature. But first, we welcome Winona Howder back to the show. Now, Winona Howder is the founder and director of Food and Water Watch in Washington, D.C., and she wrote a book called Foodopoly, The Battle Over the Future of Food and Farming in America. It's a powerful book in that all the kind of facts and ideas she's put in here that really make us wrestle with where we are going with food. She takes us back into history to talk about the difference between parity and subsidy, when we think about farming and where farming is going in the world today. She looks at everything from synthetic animals to what happens on our farms today, the battles over organic food, what they really mean, and more, and how people lost the farms, how we pushed people off farms in this country in the 30s, 40s, and 50s and put them in the cities, and how that changed the nature of farming and agriculture in our society. So we begin a series of conversations with her over the next few weeks, and we start with this today.
There are two words here I'd like to start with. One is parity, and the other is subsidies. Because they get very confused, and they're part and parcel of the history you tell from the beginning, and it winds its way all through the book.
Yes. Well, farmers in the 1920s were really suffering. They were being paid 50% below the cost of production for commodities. And so when the Roosevelt administration came into office as part of their economic development plan and a way to help people start making a living again, they proposed several changes in agriculture policy that became the 1933 Farm Bill. And since that time, about every 5 years, there's a Farm Bill. And what they wanted to do was to ensure that the rural population was paid on par with the rest of the American population, and they called it parity, a word that really isn't part of our vernacular today. So they created several programs, a grain reserve that would house grain when there was overabundance and where it could be released during times of drought, and it would help stabilize prices. And they instituted a set-aside program that would take land out of production so that there would not be overproduction of grains, because the bane of farmers is overproduction. And what happens when there's overproduction is the price of the grain plummets. The beneficiaries of that low price are the grain traders and the companies that need commodities as ingredients. And so the idea was to have some stability in the market. And then they also created programs that would make a price floor so that the price wouldn't fall below the cost of production for farmers. These policies worked really well into the 1940s, produced food for World War II. And it raised the standard of living for rural people. And over 50% of the population lived in rural areas at that time.
That's something people don't realize, what you just said. Over 50% of the population lived in rural areas, and a huge percentage of people were farmers.
Absolutely. And today, only 16% of the population lives in rural areas. And we have fewer than a million full-time farmers. But there were business leaders that weren't in favor of these agricultural policies, and that was for several reasons. And they envisioned a new economy for the U.S. based on manufacturing, and they knew that they needed cheap labor. So one of the groups that got together to start lobbying and advocating for these policies was called the Committee for Economic Development. And it was started by one of the, the CEO of Studebaker, the CEO of Kodak, an individual who was one of the first people to study public relations and consumer research. And they formed this Committee for Economic Development to start building this new economy in the U.S. And one of the things that they thought was necessary was to get young men off the farm and to reduce the rural population. And there were two reasons for this. The first reason was they needed cheap labor, and they needed young men coming back from World War II and being born at that time not to go into farming. And also they had a political agenda, because farmers had been on the cutting edge, the vanguard of populism. They were fighting the banks and the railroads post the Civil War, all through the 1980s and at the turn of the century. Farmers were joining with labor, and they were really advocates for progressive policies. They were running candidates for office. They were very politically active and a vibrant constituency. These men who formed the Committee for Economic Development feared this kind of populist activism in rural areas. And so they wanted to reduce the rural population, and they thought that it would benefit them economically as well. I don't think that this was some grand conspiracy, and I don't mean to even suggest that. I think this was people of a certain class who socialized together and had business relationships, and they didn't like farmers. They didn't identify with rural people, and in fact, some of them probably thought that they were even creating a better society where people didn't have to work as hard. But I do think that there were people involved in starting the CED who recognized the political power that rural communities had wielded during some of these times. And these were some of the same men who were involved in the process at Bretton Woods and creating the World Bank, and who really saw this new role for the United States in the international stage. And I think that this was, in one way, a very class-based decision. And who's to say what each of these individuals were thinking? There were quite a few individuals involved in the CED, and eventually all of the titans of industry, or most of the titans of industry, became involved and members of the CED. And I think when you read history that you know that many of these people were very smart, and they knew who their economic enemies were. So I think it was part and parcel of the same thing.
So in some ways, not to jump too far ahead, but the CED in a lot of ways were kind of a part of a fundamental historical building block that has led us to the World Trade, the WTO, World Trade Organization, and NAFTA. I mean, this is all part of a building block that has taken over 60 years to come to fruition.
There were men who were looking at how the economy would change post-World War II and wanted to use the resources of the developing world and wanted trade rules that would benefit their country and benefit the developed world and the companies in the developed world. And I think that the Committee for Economic Development was situated within that framework, men who were looking at ways to profit post-World War II and how to organize the new economy since the British Empire had been dethroned as part of World War II.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And the U.S. was the new economic power. And I think it was all part of looking at how this would how the U.S. economy would be organized. And these men also needed cheap labor, and they were interested in moving population to the areas where cheap labor was needed. And it was about getting boys off the farm, which is a quote, because it was boys who would be the labor. And so what they did is they began lobbying and in their social circles talking about the need to do away with these pre-World War II agricultural policies. And by the 1950s, early 1950s, when President Eisenhower was elected, they saw an opportunity to begin making progress in this area. The Secretary of Agriculture, Ezra Benson, was a right-wing ideologue who thought that the farm policies of the day were leading to communism. And, of course, this is during the McCarthy era, and so it was easy to
red tape. Parity was tantamount to communism.
Yes, parity, right, yes, was tantamount.
That farmers could survive on their land.
Right.
Right.
And he was positioned to begin to chip away at parity and these programs that had been instituted in 1933 and had moved forward. So fast forward a few decades, parity continued to be reduced in the 1960s, 70s, and the 1980s. And if you look back on the internet, there's footage of some of the meetings at farmers' union meetings. Phil Donahue did a big show on parity and what was happening to farmers. And at that time, the 1985 Farm Bill really reduced parity. All along, the CED had been lobbying for this. So in 1962, they released a report called An Adaptive Program for Agriculture that laid out why it was important to get rid of parity, what programs needed to be changed, why it was important to get more labor and manufacturing, how agricultural programs at the high school level needed to be eliminated. It was a plan, and it also talked about free trade and how it would be efficient to produce food elsewhere. 2 years later, in 1964, the CED came out with a report about free trade that had many of the recommendations that came to fruition with NAFTA and with the World Trade Organization and with the bilateral and multilateral treaties that are still being debated today. And so by 1996, after the U.S. had joined the World Trade Organization and NAFTA had been agreed upon, there was pressure to do away with all of the vestiges of the New Deal agriculture programs, what was left of parity, to get rid of the grain reserve, to get rid of the set-aside program that prevented overproduction. And the 1996 bill was very controversial. It was nicknamed by its proponents Freedom to Farm. Very soon, farmers were calling it Freedom to Fail. Because what happened is, almost immediately, there was a reduction in the cost of commodities and massive overproduction of commodities like corn and soy took place. So farmers were planting from fence row to fence row, trying to maximize their land and their equipment because they could no longer be assured of government support or any parity. within a couple of years, the price of corn had dropped by 50%, the price of soy by 40%. This was very beneficial for companies that use these ingredients, and they wanted access to cheap ingredients for processed food. The grain traders wanted access to cheap grains. Very beneficial for the meat industry that wanted to increase animal production on industrialized facilities. So by 1998, farms were in major trouble, and there were emergency payments made temporary. By 2002, these subsidies were made permanent.
That was Winona Howder, author of Foodopoly, The Battle Over the Future of Food and Farming in America, who's also executive director of Food and Water Watch. And we'll come back to her and more stories with Winona and her book, Foodopoly, in the coming weeks. We have a continuing story here on Soundbites on Dharmarva that started last year, as we looked at Nick's Organic Farm in Montgomery County, in land that was slated to be turned into a soccer field, and the battle to save rare and important seeds. And that battle has taken a lot of twists and turns. There is a hearing coming up this Friday to talk about that, to make some decisions around that. We are joined by Sophia Maravel, who is Education Director for the Brickyard Educational Farm, which is part of what they will turn this land into if they're allowed, and Carissa Lovelace, who is Campaign Director of Save This Soil. And Sophia Maravel and Carissa Lovelace, welcome. Good to have you both with us.
Thanks. Thank you for having us.
And let me just say, we have been in touch with Montgomery County to talk to us about this issue. I think that their decision is not to come on. We'll see before the decisions are made. But so who do I begin with? Sophia? We've been talking a lot over the months around this. And again, for a quick background, I mean, this started out, I know, Carissa, that you're with Save the Soil. It started out as a campaign to save the seeds and this farm from a soccer field, and it's morphed into something a little different, a little larger.
About 12 months ago now, Brickyard Educational Farm sprouted out of a grassroots community movement demanding outdoor and environmental farm-based education. And so this really amazing opportunity provided itself. Since this land is leased from the public Montgomery County School Board, we decided to do educational farm programming for local public and private schools in the area.
So what's at stake here Friday, Carissa?
The merits of the original lease from the school board to the county that would allow this land to be turned into soccer field is up for question. We are hopeful that the land will be able to be used for educational purposes. If that lease is deemed not valid, then everyone in the community will have a chance to submit proposals on what they would like to see the land used for. And Brickyard Educational Farm and Sophia will be proposing the very robust educational programming that we've been developing kind of together for the land.
If this process went back to the table and proposals were opened up, Brickyard Educational Farm would expand our farm-to-school field trip programming, and we would also like to start a farm incubator program as well as a seed saving program. So we would be able to, in the farm incubator program, actually train new and young farmers how to become a sustainable organic farmer as a viable economic career. And we would be providing through those farmers produce that would hopefully then sell back to the Montgomery County Public School cafeterias. So we'd be able to incorporate a lot of different components under this umbrella nonprofit of Brickyard Educational Farm.
What can you speak to in terms of the arguments that some people are making? I know Montgomery County has made to us, and others have made to us on and off the record, that the whole Brickyard Farms Educational Farm idea was really just created to kind of save Nick's farm, the Nick Maravel farm.
Yeah, I think it's important for people to understand that the work that Nick Maravel, the previous farmer, did created an exceptional opportunity for Montgomery County Public Schools. They now own 20 acres of organic soil. And, we are thankful for that fact. And it seems such a waste when so many other school systems across the country are scrambling to try and find ways to incorporate outdoor education into their programs for their public schools. that Montgomery County would throw away this resource, I guess, or this, I kind of want to call it like a gold mine, you know, but we're thankful for what Nick Marvell did and think that the fruits of his labor should be used for the children of Montgomery County. So Brickyard Educational Farm was kind of a way to make lemonade out of lemons. You know, when the lease got pulled, there was an opportunity to start up educational programming. And as Sophia has talked with you about before, it was piloted with great success. So many teachers are interested in bringing their students to the farm. And it's a way to, for people that say it's just to try and keep it in the hands of a private farmer, it's actually a way to share the results of his time there with the entire community.
Yeah, and I would just add on to that and say that this is a movement to start an educational nonprofit so that this precious soil can be saved and shared with a much larger population in Montgomery County. So like Carissa said, I think we're just making lemonade out of lemon. So
and what would be the alternative? I mean, what's going to be decided on Friday night?
Well,
and where will it be?
It's actually Friday morning, mm-hmm. 9 a.m. at the courthouse in Rockville on Monroe Street. And the judge is going to hear the merits of the lease from the school board to the county. If he decides that that it was fine and that that lease will stand, then the county will go through with its lease to MSI, or Montgomery Soccer Incorporated, and the land will be bulldozed and leveled for a few playing fields and some parking lots. If the judge decides that the lease is not legal and that then the entire process will be restarted, and so they will be opened up for proposals for the use of the land, and I'm sure MSI will propose using it for soccer fields. Brickyard Educational Farm will propose using it for educational purposes. There could be some other proposals. And then there will be a public hearing regarding those proposals and public space for public comment on what citizens of Montgomery County would like to see the land used for.
Right, and so we're hoping that this being public school board land, the citizens will show support for projects and proposals that actually benefit the public and benefit our school children. Since it's public school board land, the MSI ball field would be for MSI members only. They would not be open to the community necessarily. It's not a place where you could just take the ball around with your parent. So that's what our vision is for the land.
And so what about you? Apparently you are gathering some folks together to support this or to meet about this week?
This is a very important issue to a lot of people, especially in the communities surrounding. So, you know, Bethesda, Rockville, Potomac, Wheaton, Silver Spring, you know, this programming could benefit children all over Montgomery County. And even, you know, the D.C. and Virginia area. So I'm confident that there's a lot of people that are going to want to be present at the hearing to hear what happened. And, you know, we're going to probably have a large showing. And so afterward, I think we'll be gathering. I think we're supposed to be about an hour-long hearing. And we could get an answer at the end of that hearing. We could get an answer in a few days. It could be months as well before we get that answer. So I'm sure there's some people that come out to listen and find out what the next step is. We're going to gather outside afterwards and just, you know, continue to be hopeful that this land can be used for educational purposes. I mean, soccer is an important part of so many families' lives in the region, and we are big supporters of it. I think, Sophia, you were actually played with MSI, correct?
Yes, I did. I play with MSI, and our missions are actually very similar. If we want to have healthy, active, fit children, we need not only to feed them healthy food, but we also need to provide opportunities for them to get adequate exercise. So we're really in line with MSI. We just think that there's space for both activities in this county.
Yeah, and so, you know, hopefully MSI can find a location that works for them, for fields, and, you know, kids can come and learn about the foods they need to eat that are going to help them play the best soccer they can, hopefully somewhere else.
So tell me, Carissa and Sophia, if people want to be in touch, how do they get in touch for more information from you?
You can go to SaveThisSoil.org. You can email me at Carissa, that's C-A-R-I-S-S-A, at SaveThisSoil.org. You can, and then Sophia, I guess they can reach you.
Yeah, you can also go to www.brickyardeducationalfarm.org, and you can email me. That's Sophia, S-O-P-H-I-A, at brickyardeducationalfarm.org.
Sophia Maravel, Education Director of Brickyard Educational Farm, and Carissa Lovelace, Campaign Director of Save the Soil. Thank you both so much. We'll stay in touch, and we'll talk to you Friday afternoon, see what happened.
Wonderful. Thank you so much, Mark.
Right now, we have to take a very short break, but don't go away. When we come back, we'll be joined by Dr. Lauren Gerritsen, Professor Emeritus of Pediatrics at Emory University, for a conversation on pesticides and our children's health. Hello, I'm Mark Steiner again, and welcome back to Soundbites on Delmarva. We continue our conversations about pesticides and the Pesticide Information Act winding its way through the Maryland State Legislature and the importance of that bill and the debates around that bill. On December 30th, last year, 2012, there was an opinion piece written in the Baltimore Sun entitled, "We Need More Information About Pesticides. Health officials in Maryland are kept in the dark about when and where dangerous chemicals are used." One of the authors of that piece was Dr. Lauren Gerritsen, along with Dr. Richard Humphrey. And Dr. Lauren Gerritsen is a retired pediatrician, retired professor from Emory University School of Medicine, board certified in both pediatrics and toxicology, and joins us here in our studios in Hamden. And Dr. Lauren Gerritsen, welcome. Good to have you with us.
Thank you. Good to be here.
So when I read the article over the holiday, I was immediately struck by it because this has become such a point of controversy in the world of science and in terms of the interest involved in the chemical industries about just what we know and don't know about the effect that pesticides and perhaps other chemicals have on human beings. I mean, it is really people are battling this back and forth. You hear many are, I guess, saying, "Oh, the science isn't there yet."
Well, yes, that's the problem. Is some of the science just isn't there. With pesticides, we have since right after the Second World War, we have become very knowledgeable. That's when the study really got started, and we have become very knowledgeable about the acute effects of pesticides on the human body and on other animals and plants and what have you. What we're now talking about are what you could call either developmental or chronic, one or the other or both, effects of pesticides, which occur when you have no acute symptoms from the exposure to the pesticide, but they have effects on us in the long term. And that's where our focus is now and what we have been talking about and why we believe that we should have better information about the exposure of humans to the pesticides we use in our society.
What is it that you think science is confident about when it comes to the effect that pesticide has on human beings? I mean, people talk about setting clusters of people places where there's a high instance of autism or neurological disorders. I mean, what are you confident that we know?
we have many epidemiological studies. Now, what's an epidemiological study in this context? You look at an end result, a cancer or a developmental injury to children, or a malformation of the human body that you pick up when a child is born. And you say, could this be associated with something else? And we have looked, many very fine researchers have looked at those associations. And what we have are very compelling associations between pesticides and some of those endpoints. Where we do not have the kind of information that permits you to say, aha, that's a cause, because we don't have good dosage information, that's very hard to come by. And that's why we are supporting this law, because it gets us a little closer to knowing where we can look for good dosing information. Let me expand on that a little further.
Mm-hmm.
In childhood, the most common cancer in children is a disease called acute lymphoblastic leukemia. Most commonly, we call it just ALL. The most common cancer in children. You always must start this kind of a conversation by saying that what has happened in pediatrics in the last 40 years, well, 40 years was when the successes started. The work on it started well before that. This takes you back to the time that I entered medical school. The work on how to treat that disease. When I got out of medical school, 100% of all children with that disease their parents could be guaranteed that they would be dead within 6 months. Now, 90% of all of those children are cured. No treatment. The other 10% are harder.
Mm-hmm.
That's irrelevant. We've gone from 0 to 90% cure. But what's happened in that same period of time is the incidence of that disease has steadily risen, so that we have more children now who get that disease than we had 60 years ago. No one knows for sure why it's getting more frequent. Thank goodness that we can treat it, but the treatment's horrible. It's drug therapy. It's really tough treatment. Now, one of the things that people have done is to look to see what in our environment could be causing Americans to have this steady increase of that disease. And one of the things that's been looked at has been pesticides. And so you look to say who is exposed and who isn't exposed. Well, you look to see where pesticides have been used, or has the mother or the father been in an industry where pesticides were used. We have this large national study of farmers looking at that, because these pesticides are used more commonly in farms. Now, the problems that come up there are, we don't know exactly how much the child who is in his mother's womb is getting exposed. Mm-hmm. And we don't know to what, because a farmer, for instance, isn't exposed just to one pesticide, but usually to several. Even if you're in your home and you're spraying for cockroaches, or you're trying to keep ants out of the pantry, the pesticides are more than one. So you have not only what pesticide the child has been exposed to, but what dose. And that's been the problem. However, in studies that have tried to do that, using other ways of guessing about the dose, such as that your mother did work in the industry, or that you are on a farm where it was used, or that, etc., there has been, with many studies now, an association between those people who we are identifying as possibly having an increased exposure as compared to those who don't have that kind of exposure. We find a increased incidence of acute lymphoblastic leukemia, ALL, in those who have been exposed. And some of these are really rather significant increases of the incidence of the disease. But we don't know for sure which ones of these kids have gotten that exposure. We don't have a firm handle on exposure.
Mm-hmm.
That can basically be said about everything else that you can say in answer of your question, what do we know and what do we not know? We have some really very compelling epidemiological studies on that disease, and another disease that's just compelling this country in its care for children is ADHD.
Attention
deficit hyperactive disorder.
Mm-hmm.
And yes, that has been very clearly linked to one exposure, one group of pesticide exposures in a very compelling way. But again, we don't have a strong handle on the exposure data that lets us make the kind of links that you ask about what do we know for sure.
So when you make a statement like in this article, and it was really very compelling, but when it says pesticides pose the greatest risk to the smallest among us, infants and children, pesticide exposure during pregnancy and childhood is now linked to certain childhood cancers and other conditions. And we're talking about linkage here. And this is part of the argument that I think that people who oppose the Information Act would say, look, we're talking about links. We don't know this is for sure. We don't know pesticides are the cause of this exponential rise in certain disorders in our society, neurological disorders, other disorders that we're seeing in numbers we've never seen before as long as we've been studying these disorders. But understanding what this word now is, what it means to be now linked to. Do you know what I'm saying? I mean, this is an important distinction that we have to wrestle with.
There are several problems that you've brought up. The people who are opposing to this are people who are in the pesticide business, who are farmers, and those who support our farming activities. Now, you always have to look at the background that we're going in under here. Our agricultural enterprise is fabulous. And part of the reason it's so productive and is because of the chemicals that we use to help us do our farming. The examples, of course, are the insecticides that control insect damage in many of our crops, apples or what have you, that kind of thing, something that's a lively enterprise in my community. Then there is the one that's the biggie in Maryland is that we use a herbicide to control the weed growth on our cornfields.
Atrazine.
Now, atrazine is one of those magical compounds that has almost no acute human toxicity. The farmer's not at danger putting that out, unlike putting out, say, insecticides. They're danger to the guy that's putting it out who's got to protect himself. Not atrazine. Atrazine is enormously effective for controlling weeds. It is. It means that we don't have to till in order to get rid of reeds, and therefore we don't have a topsoil loss. I mean, this is really a good compound for farmers. But there is a human malformation, an infant malformation. You don't know about it till they arrive, which is a malformation of the intestine. And it can be relatively mild, or it can be an absolute disaster. When I first entered pediatrics, when we saw the absolute disasters, we basically put them in the mother's arms and said they were going to die. We couldn't do anything about them. It was a disaster. Now we can do things, but not really well. Now, how do we link that? Well, children who are conceived at about the time, and they live in a farming community, at about the time atrazine use is heavily, is a major activity on farms, are the ones that are at risk. This is a malformation that doesn't occur steadily throughout the year. Now it does to a certain extent. You see this malformation coming on, and we've had this malformation around for 100 years, long before atrazine. But at the peak time of atrazine use, if you happen to be conceived about a month before that, that's you are at the peak risk for getting that disease. Now there are three good studies that provide that epidemiological correlation. But what we don't have is cord blood levels, mother's levels when they're 2 months pregnant, et cetera, et cetera. The kind of thing that will nail down a known exposure to atrazine that then can be linked statistically to the occurrence of this malformation. But that's one of the more compelling ones. I've mentioned how compelling the studies are about ALL, and now this huge national study that came out showing the association of pesticides and ADHD, where you mentioned the word autism. The link there is less, but our problem with autism, this is a disease that was first described by a Baltimore physician back in 1937, and we thought it was right uncommon. The disease has become more and more and more common, so that you can't just write it off on being a genetic disease.
Mm-hmm.
So everyone is looking for something else to go with a genetic setup to cause the incidence of this disease, and we've been through the periods of blaming lead and mercury and all sorts of things, but nothing has really stuck. We don't know what's causing autism, and there are studies that are not as compelling as some of the others I've just referred to that have linked autism with pesticide use. This is a situation where we're desperately looking for that link, that environmental toxin is what the belief is, that there is an environmental toxin, and pesticides are just high on everybody's list.
So I know we interviewed some months back, and we'll bring him on again, Dr. Tyrone Hayes, who's written a lot about atrazine and its role as an endocrine disruptor and environmental contamination, and did a lot of work with frogs and hermaphroditic frogs and the like. And those are the kinds of things that people are arguing that we need to learn more about. So the question is, but people are arguing, saying, well, you might want to learn about this, but what about me? I have to kind of report all this stuff? I mean, you know, the farmers have to report this stuff, and people who are commercial applicators have to report this stuff. And some would argue, this is not what you're here for today, but some would argue that if they have to do it, then the normal homeowner who sprays all kinds of toxins on his house should maybe fill out a form saying, I bought this, I'm using this. we really want to understand the depth of this issue.
Well, that's true. It's the homeowner does use these, or many homeowners do. There are some of us who don't,
right.
for the reasons you might understand. But we just have to put up with a few more weeds in our lawn. But yes, there is a, when you get down to just the poundage of use, agriculturally is where the big use is, agriculturally and then institutionally in keeping pests out of institutes. The thing that this bill does is takes cognizance of the fact that all farmers must keep a record of all the pesticides they use now. And what this bill does is merely says on an annual basis, you must share that information with the state so that the state can put it together in a geographically important way, and so that we can know where the amount, where the various amounts of all the pesticides, be they, we should say this somewhere, that pesticides, that word pesticide includes insecticides, it includes herbicides, rodenticides, things you kill rats and mice with, molluscicides, killing slugs and snails, and so on. It includes all of those. It's a catch-all term, pesticides is. And so till we know where they're used, if what that permits, it doesn't permit the kind of dosage information we ultimately will need, but it will help focus our attention on those places where there may be unusually high exposure. And as you, if you were to get a focus on that, then that would possibly permit someone to go in and do the study on a population where you have the likelihood of getting high exposure, low exposure, and looking for known endpoints such as I mentioned, ADHD or what have you. And that's the way we're going to get the kind of information that says, yes, it does seem to cause this disease, or no, it doesn't. For a physician looking at all this thing, I really have to throw this in. Every physician goes through this kind of thinking as a part of their life. Every drug that comes out has side effects. I mean, heaven's sakes, we don't use aspirin very much anymore except for old guys trying to keep them from having a heart attack. I've had mine today. Thank you.
Not your heart attack, but your aspirin.
Right. But back in the days when we were using aspirin heavily before Tylenol came on the market, my goodness gracious, we knew the side effects of aspirin. It has side effects. You have to learn to put up with the side effects. And that's kind of the way I look at this pesticide issue. If we have problem with the pesticides, we're going to have to learn to live with them. Now, that's a little frightening because, as I mentioned, for instance, the atropine is the easiest one to see. It's such a beneficial drug. If we're going to have to do something to modulate that, you know, some people would say, okay, stop using atropine. Boy, that's a big call because it's such a beneficial drug to farmers. But how do you separate fetuses from the application of pesticides? I don't think we know how to do that. But we're going to have, if we find the link between a good, the kind of link that you asked me in the beginning, do we have? And I have basically said, no, we don't have it for anything. I have some things I think we're more likely to find there is a solid link. When we find that solid link, what are we going to do about it? We're going to have to learn how to make sure that our fetuses are protected. We're going to have to make sure that we learn how to make sure our young children are protected. And that's going to be work. But that's always been true.
You write in here as well that a 2012 article by the National Institute of Environmental Health Sciences shows that long-term, minutely low-level exposure to certain pesticides may be just as harmful as high levels of intermittent exposure and may affect greater numbers of people.
Absolutely. That's the whole issue, is that some of these things can happen, seem to have an effect at a very low level. That's where we started. I said separating right. this from the acute disease, but this is really small. Have we ever had to deal with that kind of a thing before? Oh, yes. We're in Baltimore, where we, I think most of your listeners are going to be very proud and happy that they are in Baltimore. But in Baltimore, some back in the 30s, was when we first linked lead to damaging effects of children. And over the years, we have gradually lowered the levels that we have been able to prove have caused injury to children.
Mm-hmm.
The horror of lead is that we no longer recognize a level of lead that will not affect the intellectual growth of children. That sounds a little spooky. Maybe we all would be a whole lot smarter if we didn't have a little bit of lead in us. But when you recognize that our blood lead levels are 100-fold higher than what we estimate we should have if we were living before the Industrial Revolution brought so much lead into our lives, we're already way up. So we're way up that scale, even though it's what we call the normal level in our society. But here is a compound that is affecting us right on down to very small levels, but we have affected an enormous change in our population's lead levels. And we have done, we just learned how to do it, and we did it as a society. We had to do it as a society. You can't do it one person at a time. And we learned how to deal with lead as a society, and we've had enormous success. There is an example where we made the link, and society took it on, and we found a way to get around it. Now, I am just enough of an optimist to think that in this great United States of ours, if we make a link with a pesticide and it's harming our children, we'll go after it and we'll fix it. But I'm also not naive to know that this is not going to be without great agony and effort.
We've been talking with Dr. Lauren Garretson. He's a retired Emory University Medical School professor, boarded in pediatrics and toxicology, co-authored with Dr. Richard Humphrey the op-ed piece, the opinion piece in the Baltimore Sun last December 30, 2012, which we'll link to, called We Need More Information About Pesticides. And Dr. Lauren Garretson, thank you so much for coming to our studios and joining us today.
It's been my pleasure.
I'd like to thank all of our guests this evening, Winona Howder, Sophia Maravel, Carissa Lovelace, and Dr. Lauren Garretson. The Mark Steiner Show and Soundbites on Delmarva is a production of the Center for Emerging Media and made possible in part by the Town Creek Foundation. Our producers are Bobby Marvin Holmes, Stephanie Mavronis, and Mark Gunnery. Our theme music is by Wal Matthews of Clean Cuts. And for WEAA 88.9 FM, the voice of the community, I'm Mark Steiner. Take care.